Welcome to this podcast from Christchurch London. For more information and resources, please go to christchurchlondon.org.
Last week we looked at kind of some general background stuff to the Gospels, who was in charge, who was in power at the time when the Gospels were set. We looked a little bit about the Roman Empire, a little bit about Herod and how the kind of interaction between Rome and the Jewish rulers went about and what kind of implications that might have had for the first century. And then we looked at the Christmas accounts because, you know, I can't let Christmas go. So we looked at the Christmas accounts and we tried to apply some of the knowledge that we learned last week to see how we can reread the Christmas accounts and think what it must have been like for a first century Jew and therefore how the writers had deliberately chosen to portray the birth of Jesus. And we saw, I hope, that Jesus was portrayed as being a challenge to both the Roman Empire, the Roman rule, and also to the Jewish rule as well. And you can kind of catch up with that if you would like. But today what I want to do is talk about something that maybe we should have talked about on week one, actually, which is what are Gospels anyway? And kind of why are we reading them? And I want to offer some basic principles for how to go about reading the Gospels and getting the most out of them. And in a sense, this might be a bit, well, I hope it is foundational in a good sense, that it will teach us stuff that will be very useful as we go through. For some of you, it might be that you kind of feel like, yeah, I've heard some of this before. A lot of it, to be honest, is just good common sense. But I hope it will be helpful nonetheless. And then in weeks 3 and 4, we're really going to put this into practice and start looking at each of the Gospels in turn. We'll do Matthew and Mark next week, Luke and John in the 4th week. And I'm really excited about those 2 weeks, which is not to say I'm not excited about today. It's just yeah, I can't wait for next week. That'll be good fun. But today, feel free, as always, just to ask questions as we go. I'm aware that I'll probably raise some questions this week that I know will get answered next week and the week after. So if I shelve your question, don't be offended. We will come to it, I pretty much promise. But okay, let's look at the Gospels and consider what are the Gospels. So if you turn to the second page of your handouts, I want to begin by thinking about this question: what type of books are the Gospels, and how does that therefore affect the way in which we should read them? And I think it's fairly obvious that knowing what kind of book you are reading is essential if you're going to know how to interpret it and to get the best out of it. So asking this question, what are the Gospels, is very important. And I think that one of the reasons people often struggle with the Gospels or have certain objections to things in the Gospels is because perhaps they misunderstand the genre and what the writers are actually trying to do and what they're not trying to do. So what are the Gospels? Well, the first thing to note, really, which is fairly straightforward and obvious, but is important nonetheless, is that they are not books written by Jesus. And that may just seem like it doesn't even need to be said, really, but I think it's important because it means that they are the works of people who are interpreting the life of Jesus, who are deliberately collecting things that Jesus said and did and were said about Jesus and putting them together for a particular purpose. So we have 4 Gospels, traditionally known as Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. None of them were written by Jesus, and yet they do claim to contain the very words and deeds of Jesus himself, and therefore to reflect Jesus' own teaching and ministry and aims and ideals. None of the Gospels actually claim to be Gospels, which may sound like another slightly strange thing to say, but none of them actually say this is the Gospel of Matthew or this is the Gospel of Mark or Luke or John or whatever. So actually, when we think about what the Gospels are, we do have to ask what is the genre? What is the genre that we're dealing with here, and what do they even claim to be? But actually, I think the word gospel is quite a useful term to describe what we have in these 4 books. And the word gospel, actually the Greek word euangelion, means good news. It means good news. And actually, before the Gospels were written, that word was used throughout the Greek world. And it was often used to refer to news about political victories or maybe military victories. And so people would go to war and they would return and they would talk about the good news, the euangelion. They would talk about this victory that had occurred. Or as we saw last week, people would talk about the good news, the gospel of Caesar, which is that Caesar is the one in whom the turning of the ages has come, and there is no other name except for the name of Caesar by which man could be saved. And they would talk about the euangelion, the good news. And I think that's a great way of thinking about what we have in the gospel accounts. It is essentially the good news about Jesus. So if you were to look at Mark 1, verse 1, it starts off by saying, this is the beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. And from the very first verse of Mark, he's saying, my whole focus is on the good news. That is, I think, the victory, well, not political, not military victory, but the victory, the powerful news that has come to a head in the person of Jesus. And if you read through Matthew and Mark and Luke, and particularly the early chapters, you find that wherever they go, they preach this gospel, this evangelion, this good news. So the gospels are perhaps first and foremostly good news texts. They want to not simply record some facts, but declare that something has happened, which we ought to find to be good and encouraging and life-changing, the good news of Jesus. But the second thing to note is exactly what kind of genre they are. I don't think gospel is necessarily a genre of text in itself. And I think the best way to think about the gospels is as biographies. Actually, there was a category in the ancient world, a category of text known as bios or bios, which were essentially biographies. They were Greco-Roman texts that depicted someone's life. And I think there's a lot of work that has been done to show that essentially the gospels follow the patterns of these ancient texts, these biographies. And I won't get into that too much, but if you want to read more about that, Richard Burridge, who is actually the dean at King's College London, is a brilliant scholar. He has written some really convincing work comparing the biographies, the Greco-Roman bios, with the Gospels and showing how they follow similar sorts of patterns. And I think, I'm personally convinced that he is right, that the Gospels essentially are bios. They are biographies of this ancient type. Obviously, biographies in those days may be different to biographies these days, and so it's worth just teasing out some of the similarities and the differences. Just a couple of highlights from Burridge's scholarship, and I recommend you check him out if you want to read more. But ancient bios generally followed particular sets of rules. They often began with the arrival or the birth of the main character, as in fact two of the Gospels certainly do. Well, in fact, arguably all of them do, but to different degrees. And they end with the death. And typically in these Greco-Roman books, a lot of attention was paid to the death of the individual because it was believed that the way a man died told you a lot about the way the man lived. And of course, that's what we find when we turn to the Gospels. We find it begins with Jesus arriving on the scene, whether through his birth in Matthew and Luke or a bit more sort of mid-ministry, his arrival on the scene in Mark and in John. And then it ends with a long exposition of his death because the way in which Jesus died tells you a lot about the way in which Jesus lived. And in between, in these kind of Greco-Roman biographies, typically you would have a collection of stories and sayings all arranged to say something particular about that person's life. And whilst these documents were historical in that they claimed to say things that were true and had genuinely happened, I think there are certain expectations that we tend to put upon the Gospels that were simply not the case in these ancient biographies. So they were thought of as being historical documents, but they weren't expected to be strictly chronological in order. That's simply not what the genre typically did. They are often arranged thematically in order to emphasize the overall thrust and focus of the individual's life and work. And so in these ancient texts, you will regularly have the birth and the death, and they tend not to swap round order too much. And in between, you'll have a whole load of sayings and stories and reports about activity that will be arranged thematically depending on what it is they particularly want to draw out of that individual's life. And that, I think, is what we find in the Gospels. Just one other little note. Justin Martyr, one of the early church fathers, he referred to the Gospels as being the memoirs of the apostles. And I think, again, that's another nice way to put it. It's their experience of having lived with Jesus, having had their lives transformed by Jesus, and therefore recording it for the benefit of others, the memoirs of the apostles. So they are both gospel texts in the sense that they are full of good news, but in terms of the genre, they are probably bios. They are biographies. They are depicting the life, death of Jesus and everything in between, arranged thematically in order to make a strong point about the life of Jesus, who he was and what he had come to do. And so actually, I think if you combine those two elements together, gospel, good news, and biography, then I think that tells us something about what the gospels are and therefore how we ought to interpret them. And I think it is true, actually, that the gospels we have in the Bible are slightly different to the bios of ancient Greco-Roman times. And I think it's because they are a combination of gospel and biography, to put it in large words. They are Christological biography. That is, they are biographies of Jesus that show how the turning of the ages has come in him. They are the good news expressed in the life of Christ Jesus. They claim to be historical documents. They are arranged for a particular purpose. They are historically faithful, but they are designed to show how Jesus' life is the culmination of God's story and to convince the reader that they should believe something particular about Jesus. So, for example, if you look at the end of John chapter 20, John explains his reason for writing. He said, "These things are written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name." So for John, at least, writing these things down was not simply a way of getting some facts onto paper so that you can kind of just keep the facts locked up in a library. He wrote them so that people would see, believe, and therefore bow the knee to Jesus and have their lives transformed by him. They are meant to be convincing documents that inspire faith. And actually, just as an aside, when Justin Martyr calls them the memoirs of the apostles, it's quite possible that there he is deliberately alluding to some ancient philosophical texts, for example, the memoirs of Socrates, which were they were kind of life stories, but in order to convince people of a particular logical point or worldview. And I think Justin Martyr is saying both these are good news biographies. They are Christological stories, but they're also philosophically compelling. And I think that's what John claims of his own gospel here. He's written these things so that you may believe, and by believing you may have life in the name of Jesus. So that, I think, is, well, for me at least, a helpful way of thinking what are the gospels. And just having that in place helps us to think, how do we go about reading them and getting the most out of them? Does that make sense? Any questions at this point? Great. Okay, how did they come about? How do we end up with the four Gospels? Again, this may seem like a simple, almost sort of unnecessary thing to say, but they did not fall out of the sky in pre-written format. They did not drop into the hands of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and they go, "Oh, wow, that's incredible." it didn't happen like that. And I know that sounds, none of you really think that. I'm not seeing much shock on your faces at that point. But actually, the way we talk about, particularly as people who are people of faith, if you are indeed a Christian, we often seem to think about the Gospels as if they were sort of inspired by God and therefore humans had no role in them at all. Actually, that's simply not the case at all. And that's not even what the Gospel writers claim themselves. They are the product of hard and careful, deliberate work. And if you studied biblical studies or theology at all, in fact, actually, I haven't asked this question. How many of you... just to know, you know, how many enemies I have against me. No, that's a joke. How many of you have studied theology or biblical studies at any kind of level? Sorry, I don't mean like, have you opened a Bible once? I mean, I mean like undergrad level. Okay, postgrad. Ooh. Yep. Okay, that's helpful. That's helpful. So if you study biblical studies or theology at any kind of level, you will look at a whole load of different ways of criticizing or understanding the Bible. For example, we won't dwell on this, source criticism, which attempts to find the original sources of the documents and try and reconstruct what that might have looked like. There's form criticism, which typically breaks down the books into sections and then tries to work out what the original setting of that particular section might have been and therefore what it might have meant in its original context. There's redaction criticism, which is more to do with the kind of the idea of why and how they were all put together or the way they were. And there are all sorts of forms of criticism, all of which are very helpful, some of which will take us down sort of side alleys that are ultimately unhelpful. But I have a lot of time for all of them. In fact, I will employ some of the techniques here. But I think actually, one of the places I like to start is simply to look at the Gospels and say, what do they claim about themselves? Before we start thinking about what sources they may have drawn on, what do the Gospels actually claim about themselves as to how they came about? And if you look at Luke chapter 1, I think this gives us quite a hint and a good model. In fact, would someone mind reading out loud Luke 1, verses 1 to 4? It's on your notes, I think on page 3. Great. So Luke begins his account by talking about why he has written this gospel, this biography of Jesus. And just a few things, I think, to pull out of it. He says it is drawn from many eyewitnesses. So Luke actually was not an eyewitness of Jesus himself, and yet he has relied on the work of many eyewitnesses. Verse 2, which were sort of, orally, verbally communicated these stories about Jesus. They were written and compiled by various people. Verse 1, Luke has researched these over quite some time. He has written his own account, which was arranged for a particular purpose, namely to convince this guy, excellent Theophilus, and there are all sorts of theories about who he was and why he was writing, and we won't get into that now. Maybe we can when we look at Luke in 2 weeks' time. And they were then sent to the intended recipient in order to convince him. And so Luke claims in this little tiny four verses here that his gospel is historically accurate. It is drawn from the sources of a number of people who are trustworthy. It is based on multiple sources, including those of many eyewitnesses, and it was written for a particular purpose. And I think that's helpful because all those elements are things that we often don't think about when we imagine the gospels just fell out of the sky in some God-inspired package. Actually, they were written by people who had a particular goal in mind, who arranged these sources, who checked out the truthfulness and the veracity of them. If they weren't eyewitnesses, they relied on eyewitnesses, and they put these things together and then delivered them to someone for a particular purpose. So how did they come about? I think they came about by a lot of hard work. And of course, I also do believe that the Holy Spirit was involved in shaping that as well. But I just want to emphasize that kind of human element for a moment, because it's one that we don't often think about, but I think is very important as we come to interpret the Gospels. So turn it over to the next page. A question, and this is not a rhetorical question. I'd love you to throw out a few answers, a few thoughts. Why do we have four Gospels? Why do we have four? Any thoughts? Written for different people for different purposes. Yeah. I mean, I think that's it, really. I mean, it's quite simple. I think they were written and by different people, to different people, for different purposes. Yeah. And chances are, if you were only to be left with one of those gospels, you would probably know a lot about Jesus, and that would be good. And I imagine there'd be enough in any one of the gospels to be able to convince someone of saving faith if that's what God is doing in their life. But actually, if you were to take Mark and send it to some of the people that John wrote for, it might not hit home quite as well, because Mark may choose to phrase things in a particular way because he's writing to a completely different audience. And John might know, actually, what I need to do is emphasize these themes. So each of the gospel writers seems to have chosen things about Jesus to put in their account in order to convince a particular crowd. And on this page with the sort of pie charts, you can see the product of this criticism, which shows how actually the Gospels probably did depend to some degree on each other. And there is a phrase that is often used, you may have heard of it, the synoptic Gospels. And when people talk about the synoptic Gospels, what they're referring to there is Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And the word synoptic breaks down into two sections, syn meaning together, and optic having to do with vision or a view. And by saying that these three Gospels are synoptic, what people are saying is that they seem to share a view. They have a together view, a united view. And people generally argue, and I think they're right, that these three Gospels were probably written interdependently. That is, that some of the writers had the other texts to draw on. And the most common hypothesis is that Mark was probably written first, and that Matthew and Luke had access to Mark's account and then thought, actually, that quote won't quite do what I need it to do. And so they added to it, and they added from their own accounts, from the witnesses of other people who'd seen Jesus, and they put together something that is particularly helpful for their context. And if you are at all familiar with gospel textual, and this may be boring for some of you, but if you are at all familiar with this sort of thing, you'll know people often talk about whether there were other sources as well. So Mark might have been the first one, but is it possible that Matthew and Luke drew on other sources? And people write enormous books about this source called Q, which is an abbreviation from the German word Quell, which means source. And people imagine that there was probably this Q source that Matthew and Luke and possibly Mark had access to as well, and that all of them have drawn from that. I think, yeah, that may possibly have happened. We don't have such a source. It always struck me as slightly odd when I just did my master's in theology and at King's. And I was in the library and I was sitting there one day and I was really struggling to find a commentary on the Gospel of John that I was particularly looking for. And I found this enormous bookshelf all full of books all about this Q source that no one has ever found, but trying to reconstruct what might have been in this source. I think chances are they did have lots of sources. I think there probably was a Q and an R and an S and a T and a U and a V and a W, because Luke says, I've drawn on lots of different sources. I don't have the problem that loads of people were writing about the life of Jesus. I think that's quite probable. But I think as each writer, gospel writer, took those sources and put them together, we get first Mark. And then from Mark, Matthew and Luke took a lot of that material, applied it in their own way, added stuff, arranged it slightly differently. And then John, which is not one of the synoptic gospels, was probably written separately at a later date. And if you look at the chart, I won't go through it because it's a bit geeky, but it shows just how much material is shared between each of the gospels. 76% of Mark's gospel also appears in Matthew and Luke, for example. And that will show you just some of the sharing that seems to have gone on between the two Gospels. Let me illustrate how I think this works on the next page. The feeding of the 5,000. This is one of the few stories that actually appears in all four Gospels. And I think it quite nicely illustrates the likely interdependence and independence of the Synoptic Gospels and of John. So if you look at the first table there, the number of words that are used to tell the story in Matthew 157, in Mark 194, in Luke 153, in John 199. So kind of in a similar sort of ballpark in terms of the length of the actual Gospels. But then if you were to compare the number of words that are used in each of the accounts, you find that there are 53 words that are common to each of the synoptic Gospels, that is Matthew, Mark and Luke. However, then if you look at the words in John, you find that only 8 words in John's account are common to the synoptic Gospels. And those words are 5,000, took, loaves, and 12 baskets of pieces. And that's it. And so scholars looking at that say, well, chances are this tells me that Mark, Matthew, and Luke were drawing on the same sorts of sources, hence they use similar language. But John wrote his own account independently. And if you look at the third column there as well, you can see the percentage of agreement between the Gospels. That's not to say they disagree, it's just the way they tell the story. Is it similar or different? And people conclude this, the quote at the bottom, the following conclusions seem inevitable. John represents a clearly independent telling of the story. He uses only those words absolutely necessary to be telling the same story. And he even uses a different Greek word for fish. Who knew there were more than one Greek word for fish? The other three are just as clearly interdependent in some way. Those who know Greek recognize how improbable it is for two people independently to tell the same story in a narrative form and have a 60% agreement in the words used, and often in the exact same word order. So that, I think, just shows one example of how the Gospels were written, three of them probably depending on each other, Mark first and then Matthew and Luke, John separately, probably at a later date. You still with me? Does this feel a bit technical at the moment? We'll kind of apply it in a minute, but any questions at this point? Okay, yeah. So the question for the recording was about exaggeration. Is there any exaggeration in the Gospels? And how do we know? And the reference was back to things in Joshua where I argued in a sermon 2 years ago or whatever. Well done for remembering. I argued that actually it was ancient. It was common in those texts to use exaggerated language about war rhetoric, particularly, I think the context was. So in the Gospels, I think actually biographies were genuinely trying to be historically accurate. So there wouldn't have been the same sort of exaggeration in that example. It was done for a particular cause in order to strike fear into the hearts of enemies of Israel and the ancient nations. But I think If you're asking, are there any rhetorical devices that are used that need interpreting? Absolutely, definitely. There is metaphor, and there are all sorts of images. And yes, slightly exaggeration, but I don't think it's an exaggeration of facts, maybe just a particular telling of the story to draw out particular things. We'll come to that in a while. But yeah, I mean, some people say, should you take the Gospels literally? And I think, well, it depends what you mean by that. And G.K. Chesterton said, I think someone asked him, do you take the Gospels literally? And he said, well, Jesus said that Herod is a fox, but I don't imagine that he had bushy tail and, you know, pointy ears. Jesus said, I am the door, but I don't imagine that Jesus was flat wooden and swung on hinges. You know, so you've got to be sensible in the way we apply metaphor and heightened language and rhetoric and that sort of thing. But I think the Gospels claim to at least be historically accurate, so I wouldn't say they're exaggerated in that sense. I can't see who it is at the back. Yes, that's a really easy question. Yes, there are more questions like that, please. Okay, how about someone run down as a representative? Great. Otherwise, I'll run up the stairs and then I'll be out of breath for the rest of the... Excellent. Okay, let's keep going and we can come back to some more questions as we go. Turn over to the next page. So we have four Gospels. In fact, actually, before we look at this, question for you. I think the Gospels are sometimes hard to get our heads around for all sorts of reasons. I imagine I'm not the only one in this room. What difficulties do you have when reading the Gospels? What makes you struggle to know how to interpret them? Throw out a few ideas. Just me. I'm the only one. Anyone struggle at all, ever? Go for it.
Mm. And then there's another whole story after that, but in the middle there's always a few verses where you're like, I have no idea what they're about.
Yeah, okay. So your problem there is less with the Gospels and more with devious preachers. No, I get what you mean. Okay, so there are stories that are familiar, and actually maybe collections of stories, and then in between a couple of verses that are slightly complex, and you think, how on earth do I interpret that? Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Okay, so yeah, Jesus is talking about something or other, and then he seems to just make this throwaway comment, and you think, hang on, what does that have to do with anything? And have you got any particular examples in mind? Or Okay, yeah, so sometimes it seems like Jesus is doing something or other, and then he just says something, and you think, hang on, Jesus, have you just gone off on a tangent? And you've got to ask at that question, at that point, did Jesus do that, or is that the gospel writer who has done that? And what might be the particular reason? We'll tease out some of that in a bit. Yep, go for it. That's a great question. Yeah, so early on, it seems like Jesus does loads of miracles and people know about it. And then, yeah, as time goes on, or at various points, he seems to say, actually, keep the secret. Actually, I realize that asking these questions, I now want to answer all of them. But we'll come to that in another week, actually. That's a great question. But the more broad principle there is Jesus does things or says things and you think, but how does that work? So some of it's just baffling, isn't it? Some of it's baffling. Sometimes you think, what's the connection? I don't understand the connection. A few things that I find difficult about them. Sometimes the phrases seem to be like, they don't make a lot of sense in English to me, in the sense that they seem to be idioms that I think, I don't know how that applies here. Or sometimes it says, this was done in order to fulfill X. And then you read the passage and you think, how does that fulfill that? I have no idea at all. Or worse still, you look at it and you think, hang on, it looks like Matthew's a really bad theologian here, because what is he? That's even out of context. What is going on there? And so going back to the Old Testament, sometimes I find that tricky. I find it tricky when you then compare the Gospels to each other and you think, hang on, that point was there in that Gospel and then it seems to be slightly different in this Gospel. So how do you tie all these sorts of things together? Well, that's kind of what I want to look at really at the end of this session and then increasingly over the next few weeks. So On the next slide, why do they differ? We won't look at this really, but you may find it helpful. There's a table there on the left-hand side that shows many of the stories that are shared between Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and the fact that they are in a different order in each gospel. And some people find that quite troubling. I personally don't, for reasons I'll explain in a minute. But that table may be an interesting reference point if you want to look at some of these things. Two things I would like to just draw out before we start actually looking at some of the accounts. I think when we come to the Gospels, we need to understand that the reason why sometimes they are different to one another is because the authors were selective. The authors were selective, first of all. That is, they had a whole load of stories about Jesus, many of which they knew and had experienced themselves or heard from others who were reliable sources. And they had to make some kind of selection over which ones they keep in and which ones they throw out. They didn't document everything that Jesus did. In the Gospels, even the four of them, we don't have documents of every single thing that Jesus did. I wish we did, but we don't. In fact, even John admits that in John 20 and 21, he says this: Jesus did many other signs in the presence of the disciples, which are not written in this book. There are also many other things that Jesus did. Were every one of them to be written, I suppose that the world itself could not contain the books that would be written. There might be a slight exaggeration, there you go, to go to Subin's point. But I think it's at least a clear claim that Jesus did much that we don't have time or space to fit in every gospel. And so the authors don't claim to have recorded every single thing that Jesus said or did. They were selective. They chose to keep certain things and to leave certain things out. Incidentally, and just a throwaway thought, perhaps in a Jesus style, I think it's quite plausible that many of the things that we have recorded are things that Jesus might have said and done multiple times. I think it's a mistake to assume that Jesus only told the same sermon once and did the same miracle once. I think it's highly plausible that wherever he went, he might have told stories and the stories may have been similar. So, for example, I sometimes preach at other places around the country when I'm not at Christchurch, and I reuse sermons, and I reuse jokes, and I try and make them sound as fresh as the first time, and it's not always easy. And I reuse stories, and sometimes I might use the stories in a slightly different way according to the place that I'm preaching, maybe the crowd I'm preaching to, maybe the particular point I'm trying to make. So here at Christchurch, I might tell a story about something that genuinely historically happened in my life, and I might apply it in one particular way. And then I go up to, you know, Manchester or whatever, I'm speaking to a different crowd, and then I think, oh, that story would be really helpful, but not in the same sort of way I applied it. And I don't change the facts, I simply apply it in a slightly different way. Now, if you were to meet one of my friends from Manchester and say, oh, yeah, I heard that talk where Liam told that story about him, I don't know, rescuing a cat from a burning house or something like that, and that's not an actual story. But it's good. I like that, actually. But if you were to talk with them and they go, oh, yeah, I remember that story as well about how heroic Liam was and, you know, fought off flames to rescue a kitten. I don't even like kittens. That's a bad example. But you might go, oh, yeah, I remember that story. I remember that story. And then suddenly come to the application and think, oh, hang on, I remember the end and the point being slightly different. And you may not even realize that you were listening to two different versions of the same story told in different contexts for particular purposes. I think the same may be true of the Gospels. I think it's unlikely that Jesus only told the parable of the prodigal son once, for example. I imagine it was a popular one, that he would rock into a town and people would go, hey, tell that one about the kid and the, you know, pigs and people are like, oh, okay, I'll tell that one again. Yeah, I imagine that this was what happened in an oral culture when you have a guy traveling all over the place. And so sometimes you come to stories that are slightly different in each account, and sometimes you can tell because the account makes it really clear this is the same story, in which case you've got to wrestle with the contradiction or apparent contradiction. Sometimes it might just be that Jesus told the story one way in one particular place and slightly differently in a different place, and that the gospel writers are selective over it. So we've got to ask those kind of questions. Sorry for an aside, that was longer than I intended to be. But I think the authors were selective, first of all. But secondly, I think the gospel authors were also creative. That is, they didn't simply select the material in the sense of saying, I will keep that and not that. But they actually creatively arranged the material as well for a particular purpose. And that, I think, is why we can have the same stories reported in multiple gospels in slightly different orders. I think the gospel writers creatively arranged the text, the stories about Jesus, to be able to draw out the particular things that they wanted to emphasize in their gospels. And that is why Matthew and Mark and Luke, and then especially John, may look different to one another. So in some accounts, you've got a whole load of miracles that are grouped together. Now, did they literally happen back to back? quite possibly not. Sometimes they're grouped together because they want to make a particular point because they're a similar type of miracle. Sometimes it's like, here are all the miracles Jesus did in Galilee. Did he do them in the same, you know, sitting? Probably not. But they've been drawn together for a particular reason. Sometimes you have, which is maybe a point someone, I forget which one of you made it over there, you got a story and then this kind of thing that seems a bit like shoehorned in, then another story and you think, why are they together? It may well be that they're together because the gospel writer wants to hammer home a particular point. And I think we need to see the gospel writers kind of like directors or editors of films who have shot this whole thing. They've got all this footage of the life of Jesus, as it were. And then they kind of look at it and they think, how do I blend this together to be able to tell an historically accurate but aesthetically or philosophically compelling piece? They don't change the facts, I would contend, but they arrange it differently in order to draw out the particular picture that they want to portray of Jesus. And actually, I mean, take the analogy a step further. You get director's cuts of films, and they look slightly different to the cut that you may see in the cinema, because the director has been like, I had to do a certain thing for that audience, that setting, those set of limitations, but if I had my way, I would portray it like this. And so you get extra scenes put in one, or a bit that's elongated, or maybe even the scene swapped round in order to draw out a point. And I think that is what the historical gospel writers were doing. Taking all these things that are true about Jesus and then saying, how do I weave these together to make the most beautiful, powerful, compelling picture of Jesus that I possibly can, that really hammers home this point for this particular audience? Now, is that okay with people, or do people find that troubling? Do people find that just like common sense? Yeah, go for it. Hmm. Yeah, sure. Okay, so I'll repeat your question for the recording. So the question is, if you start rearranging facts, don't you somehow distort the historical reality of them? I say yes and no. Yes, if you then use that to prove something that Jesus never tried to prove, or if you apply it in a way that is inauthentic, or if you do it in such a way as to make it impossible that it could be otherwise, by which I mean, if someone said, here's a miracle that Jesus did, and he definitely did it when he was 31 years old and he was in this particular place. And then someone says, actually, I'm going to rearrange that and say, this is a miracle that Jesus did, and it's the same one that guy was talking about, but he did it when he was 32 and he was in this particular place. You're creating a contradiction. At that point, I think, yeah, that something has gone wrong. But for the kind of rearrangement of stuff that genuinely happened, in a thematic way, that was a common thing to do in these ancient texts, and I don't think it's a problem at all. Once they start to twist the meaning, then you get a problem. But I think that was a common thing to do in these ancient texts, and I don't have a problem with it in that sense. We'll go here first. Yeah, sure. Okay, so the question there is, sorry, do we have anything to compare it to? Well, I think that's a very good question. And that, I think, is why different forms of criticism are helpful, to try and get to the bottom of where these ideas came from and how they've been arranged and what might have been the original context. So I have a lot of time for that kind of reconstruction. But at the end of the day, a lot of it is hypothetical. I would contend that to be fair to the Gospels, we need to treat them as historical sources, as they claim to be, and we need to recognize that there is interpretation there, as there is in any historical source. And I would say that some of the facts can be corroborated by other things. So if it's facts about particular geography or who was in power at a particular time or that sort of stuff, I would expect that some of that can be corroborated by historical sources, whether it's Roman historians, Jewish historians, you know, whatever. Obviously, when we're on the grounds of, did Jesus literally say those words or not, and did he have that kind of meaning to them, there is an element of faith in it. But I would also put it to you, and I know you probably won't like this because we talked about it last week, that's the same with anything. You pick up three copies of a newspaper today and read reports of certain things, and I'd say, well, you know, there's an element of interpretation going on in the telling of any story, and you've got to kind of trust that there's truth, but where there's contradiction, you've got to wrestle with it hard. But I say we need to come to the Gospels and trust that they themselves are historical documents as they claim to be. So we can come back to that with specific examples if that helps in due course. But okay, yep, one more question there, and then we move on. Sure. Yeah. 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 Okay, so I was just trying to think, what on earth was that question? But the point is, it is possible to manipulate things in order to create one particular outcome that might have a polemic reason behind it. So he started it. No, he started it. That kind of, you know, who started it and who's responding to who. And no, absolutely. That's true. And again, that's the risk with any ancient reporting or modern reporting. Are they being factual? Can you tell if there's a deliberate bias? Those sorts of things. Just one other thought I would throw in there, though, is that we've got to remember that these texts were written at the point where people were still alive who would have seen the stuff. And so if people were writing something down about something that Jesus said and did, and then actually they're being, you know, it's being circulated around and people are like, hang on, that's not what he said at all. And I'm not being portrayed right in that story. People are going to have the opportunity to say, no, that's not true. And in the first century, that would have shut things down, presumably. We don't have much record of that actually happening. I think obviously I'm saying that I trust for all sorts of reasons that the gospel accounts are genuine and historically accurate, but I also want to hammer home the point that they did not fall out of the sky like that. They were deliberately arranged for a particular reason. And let me just give you one example of how this works, and then we'll do some group work. If you were to compare the temptations, Jesus in the wilderness, in Matthew 4 and in Luke 4, you will find something that some people may find troubling or confusing, namely that the temptations appear to be in a different order. Anyone have a Bible to hand? One person has a Bible to hand. Andy Tuck, could you please read out for us Matthew 4, verses 5 to 10? And then could someone else find, anyone else, Elizabeth, great. If you could find Luke 4, 5 to 13, that would be great. Mr. Tuck, would you read out your passage first? Great. Okay, so this is coming to the end of the story of the temptation in the desert. And the order of those final two temptations is temple, kingdom. Throw yourself down from the temple. I'll give you all the kingdoms of the earth. Right, now let's look at Luke chapter 4, verses 5 to 13. Great. So in Matthew, we have temple followed by kingdom. In Luke, we have it the other way around, the temptation about the kingdom followed by the temple. Now, I would put it to you that both of those things happened. And I would suggest that the order is deliberately arranged for a particular reason in each gospel. I don't see that as a contradiction so much as an arrangement for a particular purpose. Now, we'd have to ask what the particular purpose might be. And we'll come to the purposes of Matthew and Luke next week and the week after, so I'm kind of jumping the gun a little bit here. But actually, in Matthew's gospel, if you read it, you find that one of the things that he talks about more than anything else and more than any of the other gospel writers is the theme of the kingdom of God. And that seems to be one of the major themes in Matthew's gospel, the kingdom all the time, the kingdom. And therefore, in telling the story about the temptations, he is genuinely reflecting the fact that all these things happened, but he has built the story in order to come to the element of the temptation that is the most telling, the most powerful for his purpose, the temptation about the kingdom. And when you've got Jesus in Matthew's gospel going around and preaching and sowing signs about the kingdom all the time, I think it's powerful that the temptation story culminates in this possibility where Jesus was challenged or tempted to take the kingdom by some other means than the means that God had intended. Luke's gospel is quite different. And the kingdom is not so much the major theme, but as we'll see in 2 weeks' time, again and again and again, the whole of Luke's gospel is focused on Jerusalem and the temple in particular. And there's so much reference to Jerusalem and the temple, more in Luke than any other gospel. And we'll come to the reasons why in the final week of this term. So I think for Luke, it made sense to actually focus the temptations on the theme that is of greatest importance to him, which is Jerusalem and the temple. And so he builds it so that the climax of the story is on Jerusalem and the temple. Both, I would say, have reflected the truth of what happened. They simply arranged it in a particular way, in a way that was common for this literature and this genre at that particular time, in order to draw out two things that are both very true about what happened in that occurrence. Okay, I'm aware that time is racing on, so I will keep going. And I'm aware as well, you may have a load of questions, but I'll be around at the end. We can talk about those further if you would like. Next slide. How then should we read the Gospels? There are loads of different suggestions for how to go about reading the Gospels. One of them I find quite helpful is based on a book by Richard Hayes called The Moral Vision of the New Testament, which is a great book on getting kind of ethical teachings out of the New Testament. It's well worth checking out. But he proposes a four-step process. He says there is the descriptive task, the synthetic task, the hermeneutical task, and the pragmatic task. And we won't go into that really right now. But essentially, I want to focus on the first two bits, what he calls the descriptive task and the synthetic task. The descriptive task is this, the first quote. He says, "The first thing we must do in order to understand the ethics of the New Testament, and I would say the New Testament in general, whether it's ethical concerns or historical concerns or whatever we're looking at, the first thing we must do is to explicate in detail the messages of the individual writings in the canon without prematurely harmonizing them. When we read the text in this way, we note distinctive themes and patterns of reasoning in the individual witnesses." Essentially, what he's saying is this: we begin by reading each gospel writer on his own terms, trying to think, what is this writer doing? What is this writer's passion? And therefore, why has he said things in this particular way? And he's right, I think. We must start there, because if we race to trying to harmonize them too quickly to say, what are all the gospel writers talking about, we might actually miss some of the subtleties of each account. So the second quote, he says this: "We must let the individual voices speak if we are to allow the New Testament to articulate a word that may contravene our own values and desires. Otherwise, we are likely to succumb to the temptation of flitting to some comforting cross-reference to neutralize the force of any particularly challenging passage we may encounter." So, for example, if you are reading through the Gospels and you look at the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew and Luke, you might say, hang on, one of them, Jesus says, blessed are the poor. Does that mean I have to somehow care about the poor? And you might not want to care about the poor. And if that is you, then we got a problem and I'll fight it out with you at the end. But you might just go, actually, but I know that Jesus says in Matthew, blessed are the poor in spirit, and therefore he can't mean I have to, you know, give money or care for the poor. And so you flip to that one and you actually miss, so you neutralize what Jesus might have been saying and what one account was deliberately trying to draw out. So I think we need to take each account on its own, first of all, before we try to harmonize. But the second task is the synthetic task. And Hayes writes this: "If we are pursuing New Testament ethics with theological concerns in view, in other words, if we want to probe these texts and find out what they genuinely say about God and God's plan for the world and how we should live and so on, we must move on to ask about the possibility of coherence among the various witnesses. When we ask this question, the synthetic question, we move from the descriptive to the synthetic task. Is it possible to describe a unity of ethical perspective within the diversity of the canon?" There comes a point, once we have looked at each passage and each gospel in turn, that we may say, or we must say, okay, how do I now compare this to Luke, Matthew, John, and so on, and try and get the full force of what Jesus may have been saying together. I think we need to ask questions about how the Gospels interact. And Ben Witherington, who is a brilliant New Testament scholar, he uses this analogy, which I find very helpful. He says, imagine you are part of an orchestra playing a piece of music. You start off not by all getting in the room and just playing it, but by you at home just learning your own individual line. And if you try and harmonize, you try and bring the entire thing together before everyone has learned their own individual line, chances are you're going to have a bit of a cacophony that's not going to be pleasant to anyone. However, the opposite is also true. If all you ever do is have individual instruments and instrumentalists sitting at home learning their line and you never bring them together, you will not get the full force and beauty of what the composer has intended. So we need to harmonize, we need to bring things together, but I think first of all we need to allow each voice to speak on its own terms. Does that make sense? So when we look at particular episodes in the Gospels, I think we need to ask first of all, why is this episode being portrayed this way in this Gospel by this writer at this particular point in time? And then once we've figured that out, we can move on to the synthetic questions. Actually, what we're going to do over the next couple of weeks is mainly the first section, the descriptive task. We're going to look at each of the Gospel writers in turn. If you move over to the right-hand side of the page, you'll see another way of just thinking about how we do this. It's very similar, really. Imagine you've got an episode right there in the center of the diagram, a particular parable or story or miracle or whatever. The first thing to do is to look at that episode itself and then widen it out and look at the episodes either side and then look at how that combination of episodes fit within the gospel as a whole. And only once you have done that, I think, are you well equipped to then ask, how does that fit with the other Gospels and the New Testament and the Scriptures as a whole? So we start with the small and we work our way out if we are to be faithful and sensible, I think, about interpreting the Gospels. So just a few principles and then we will very quickly get to an exercise to put this into practice. When faced with any episode in the Gospels, here are the questions I would start with. Ask with some basic questions. Begin with basic questions. Who? Who is this story about? Who are the main characters? There may be loads of characters in the story, but who are the ones that they're particularly focusing in on? Who are the main people? Secondly, what? I mean, literally, what is happening in the story? Ask, why? What is happening? What are the kind of overarching themes of the story? Literally, what is being reported to me? Thirdly, when? As in, when is this story taking place? And take note about things like time of day. There may be a reason why it's the morning rather than the night, for example. Think about John's Gospel, for example, often refers to hours or days. Why is he doing that? Ask those kind of questions. Think about when it sits within the calendar. Is this story happening at a particular feast or a particular time of the year? What might the weather have been like, or what would the Jewish calendar have been like at this point in time? What can that tell us about how to interpret it? Who, what, when, where? Geography. If the gospel tells you it's happening in a particular place, think, what do I know about that place? And it may be that you need to consult books to figure out what you can know about that place. But why is this happening there and not there? What would the people have been like who lived in this area? Were they predominantly Jews? Were they predominantly Gentiles? Does that help me to interpret it in any way? Why? What is the reason for the story? As in, does the author give you a clue as to why he has written this thing down? What is the particular point he is trying to make? So ask yourself those kind of basic questions about any episode and then widen it out and say, okay, what comes before, what comes after? And what might the author be trying to say by his particular arrangement of these stories? Are there common themes between them? Or rather than commonality, are there contrasts between them? Do people respond one way to one story and then another way to another? And if so, why might the author be putting them together? Is he trying to draw out a particular point? If there's a parable and a miracle next to each other, think, are they similar? Do they make a similar point from a different angle, for example? Pay attention to transitional statements. For example, if it says, once Jesus had done this, he whatever, or when Jesus heard this, he... Because I think those are clues that you are meant to link the thing before with the particular episode you are looking at. For example, Luke 14, when Jesus noticed how the guests picked the places of honor at the table, he told them this parable. I mean, you read that and you think, okay, that gives me an interpretive clue to know why Jesus said this particular thing. It gives you a framework for interpreting it. Mark 7. In saying this, Jesus declared all foods to be clean. And so Mark is throwing in this kind of hint. Oh, actually, he hadn't got the application. This is why Jesus did it. Pay attention to those kind of hints from the author. Then ask yourself, how does it fit within the larger purpose of the gospel? And we'll come to that next week. Check out scriptural quotations in their original context. Again, we'll see some examples of this next week. But when you come to a quote, go back and read the whole thing. Find out where it comes from, and don't just go back and read the particular line in Hosea or Micah or whatever. Read the whole chapter. Try and think what the original context might have meant, and therefore why the author has quoted that particular passage. And ask the basic questions about the passage that's being quoted as well, the who, where, what, why, when. And I think you'll start to see a richness to the way the New Testament writers quote the Old Testament that you might have missed otherwise. Now, that all feels a bit abstract and, you know, principle-based, and maybe that's a lot to throw at you. And maybe a lot of it seems like common sense as well, in which case I'm sorry. Well, I'm not really sorry, because it's important. But I think once we start now applying this to some of the passages, we'll hopefully see how some of it works. I imagine some of you will have questions, but let's hold those for a moment. Let's do a quick exercise, and we probably won't have time to feed all of this back, but it may just help you to apply some of this stuff. What I'd like to do is divide the room into four. So we will go up the center just here. There we go. Wow, it's like the parting of the sea, but less dramatic by quite a long way. 2, 3, 4, 5. And yeah, just behind Tim and Jerusha, we can go there. So we kind of make little quadrants. So group one. And right along, so yeah, group one, group two, and Andy and Caroline, you become group three, and group four at the back. And what I'd like you to do within those four groups in just a moment, get into fours or fives or whatever, and if you turn over to, I think, the final page of the notes, you will find four sets of stories that come next to each other. And what I'd like you to do is to take these three episodes and ask some of those questions to think, why has this particular writer put these particular stories together in this particular way? And what I'd advise is that you look at each episode in turn, ask some questions about what's going on there, and then look at the three of them together and think about whether there are any particular themes and whether they help you to interpret all of them as a whole. Does that kind of make sense as a task? Okay, so group one, two, three, four. I'll give you, say, 10 minutes, and then we'll come back and we'll look at them a little bit in depth. Okay, go for it. Okay, let's just super quickly go over this and get a feel for how easy. Well, first of all, did you find that easy or hard? Hard. Okay. Okay, did you find that any of those principles that we looked at before, you were able to sort of apply them? Did you find any connection between the three stories each of you had, or were you like, still no idea why they're together? Some of you did. Okay, but it's just teasing out what that connection is. It's a difficult thing, isn't it? Okay, well, let's really quickly go through each of the groups and just throw out a few ideas that you think might be the connection, and then I'll just give you my suggestion as what I think the connection might be. And then actually, group three definitely we'll come back to next term and do almost an entire session on that. Group one we will as well. Maybe not group four, and I can't remember what your one is, so we'll come to that in a bit. But we will go into this in more depth. So this is just to get you a feel for starting to think theologically. And then at this point, I'm almost not concerned with what answers you've come to. I'm more concerned with you developing the tools, and then we can talk it through further in future weeks. So let's start with group one. Could you shout out what your three stories were? Someone from that group. Okay. Yep, that's story one. Jesus heals two demon-possessed men. Yep. Jesus heals a paralytic. Okay, great. So what's the common theme? Yeah. Okay, great. So it's something to do with Jesus' authority, and it's something to do with people's response to that authority as well. So it's tricky because you guys all haven't read the same passages that they have, but Let's throw it out to the other people who worked on the same passage, and then I'll join the dots. Did you think anything else in particular? Interesting. Yeah. Yeah. Great. Anything to add to that? No. Yep. Yeah, brilliant. Okay, so what we've got there is, so let's try and tie all those things together. So in those three stories, we have a common theme, which is the authority of Jesus, and it's over everything. So it's over the physical creation, it's over the spiritual world, and it's over physical illness as well. And I think Elizabeth is right to say it starts with the kind of big creation, and then it works right down to a sort of group of, people and then their spiritual issues, right down to an individual. But also the converse thing is also true, that it starts with just the disciples witnessing it, and then a larger crowd, and then actually an even larger crowd witnessed the third miracle. And I think what you teased out there is really helpful, in that it's all about authority. It's authority over a number of things, and the way people respond is drawn out in each of the different passages. So the first one, you've got the disciples, and they have little faith. Jesus says they are amazed that creation obeys him, and there's a kind of a positive reaction, but it is one tinged with doubt and fear, I suppose. The second one, the story of Jesus healing the demon-possessed man, what you find fascinating there is that the crowd are terrified of him, and they say, please leave this town. And that kind of leaves you with this terrifying thought of, wow, if I see God move in power, might I be like, this is too much for me, get away from me, and miss out on something of what God is doing. So I think that's an interesting reaction. And thirdly, you've got these people who come in faith saying, Jesus, would you heal this person? The religious leaders say this is blasphemy, but the Lord of the creation completely heals them. And some people respond by saying, this is awful, this cannot be God, and other people respond in awe. And so there seems to be this comparison between the different reactions that come Jesus' way as he does incredible things. So what is the overall message of the three together? I think there is an irony here in the way these three stories are put together, that the demons get who Jesus really is and the religious leaders don't, and that pretty much everything in between happens as well. And geographically, notice one of the miracles happens on the lake and the others happen on either side of the lake. So it seems to be saying that, you know, wherever Jesus went, there was a whole range of emotions. And the big kind of rhetorical kick in the teeth is, so what's your reaction to this Son of God? And I think that's the reason why these three stories have been put together. And there are other things we could draw out of that as well, but let's move on to group two. Does that kind of make sense? And I think each of you got bits of those as well, so well done. Obviously, I've had longer to think about this than I gave to you. So group two, why don't you shout out what your three stories were, and then let's, you know, tie them together a little bit. Someone...
He says something along the lines of, don't trust the Pharisees, something like that. And they completely misunderstand what he's going on about and think he's talking about the grace.
Yeah.
And saying that they're going to starve because they're on the boat and they haven't brought enough food. And he says, don't you remember when I turned to all that food into a lot of food? Where's your faith? Move on to the second one is, Jesus healed a blind man. And then he moves on to the third bit. He goes to a town, and Jesus asks his followers, what's everyone describing me as? What do they call me? And they say, some call you John the Baptist, some people call you Elijah. And Jesus says, well, who do you think? And Peter shouts up, good man, and says, you're Messiah.
Yeah, great. Okay, so those are the three stories. Any particular links that you think come between, you know, the three of those stories?
Mm.
Great, yes. Yes. Hmm. Yep. Boom. Do you have my answers there on the paper or something? Because that's, I mean, that's great. Okay, so three stories. You get this story at the beginning where Jesus says, beware the yeast of the Pharisees. And people are like, oh, is he talking about that because we don't have enough bread? Which kind of sounds a bit weird. Like, of course, that's not what he's saying. But I understand that because people talk about spiritual things. I'm like, I'm just hungry. I want bread. So, I get the deal. But Jesus has just done this miracle where he's fed people. And they're like, oh, he must be talking about this literal thing. And they somehow can't see beyond the literal to this spiritual point that Jesus is trying to make. And it says, your eyes fail to see. Okay? And then the next story you get is a man whose eyes fail to see. I mean, quite literally, they fail to see. And if you read through the passage, just huge repetition of words. Actually, this is something I should have said earlier. When trying to figure out what's going on in the episode, one of the things to pay attention to is, like, are there words that are used again and again and again and again and again? And eyes and sight and optical sort of things are used again and again, like almost over the top to labour the point in this passage. Again and again and again, they're talking about sight. There's a blind man. He talks about blind man's eyes. Do you see? He looked. I see people. They look like trees. Jesus put hands on the eyes. Eyes were open. Sight restored. He saw clearly. It's kind of overkill, really, there. Luke is not subtle. But you're right. There is this kind of partial healing that goes on. And your question, which I think is exactly the right question, is that somehow a metaphor or a picture for what is going on in the disciples' life? And then story three, suddenly you get this idea of the eyes being opened. They clearly see something that they failed to see before. And so I think these three stories together show the partial kind of gradual healing as like an enacted parable of the growing in faith and understanding that the disciples were on. Yeah. Brilliant. Good work. Group three, your nice easy passages. What did you make of those? What were the three stories, first of all? Something about figs. You're just like the disciples there. It's like, oh, I know I'm meant to be thinking about something spiritual, but oh, I could kill a fig right now. You know. Okay. So Jesus walks past the fig tree. He sees it. What does he do? Okay, so he wants breakfast. There's no breakfast. He curses the tree. So he's a bit mean. Yeah, okay. Second story. Yep. Great. So he gets to the temple and he sees stuff going on there that shouldn't be. It doesn't seem to be doing what the temple's meant to be doing. In fact, people are doing the opposite. They've turned this house that is meant to be a prayer place of prayer for all nations into the den of robbers. And he gets a bit angry about that. Yep. And he probably still hasn't had breakfast at this point, so I understand that again. Can anyone tell that I'm really hungry and haven't had my lunch yet? Okay, and the third point. Yeah. Okay, so they go back past the fig tree and the disciples go, hey, isn't that the fig tree that you just cursed and it's dead? Yeah. Okay, now any idea why those three stories might have been put together? Apart from the fact that they probably did actually happen in that order. Something to do with, sorry, unfruitfulness, okay? Hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Brilliant. No, well, that's great. So what you've done is you said, why does this author put those stories all together? It seems to be maybe there's a common theme here, which is a lack of fruitfulness and things appearing good on the outside. But when you get underneath, there's no fruit. Yeah. And that's the case in the temple. And that seems to be the case in the fig trees. And it seems to be that they have been put together with that particular reason. And the gospel writer has decided to leave out everything else that happened on the journey, you know, whether Jesus actually did have breakfast and everything else. That he seems to have just focused on those three things with the bookends to be able to say, hey, these sort of tell a similar story. And with your three sections. The middle one was like the parable that unlocked the other two. In this one, I think it's more the case that the beginning and the end bookends help you to interpret the middle. I'll just say a couple of comments on it, but we will come back to this one and spend almost an entire session on what Jesus would have said about the temple. So there'll be loads of questions I'll leave unanswered for the moment. But I think essentially, it sounds kind of mean in the passage because it says that it was not the time for the fig tree to bear figs. And so Jesus rocks up and he's like, no figs. And you're like, no kidding, Jesus. That's how plants work. Don't you who start, you know, kind of created all these things and calmed the sea, don't you know how trees work? And it seems a little bit mean that Jesus would curse the thing. But I think what's going on there is that that's kind of the point. And that typically fig trees, the figs would appear at a similar sort of time as when all the leaves were flourishing. And so they would kind of come in a similar time, except that the leaves would slightly predate the figs. And so the point really is, well, there was no fruit because it was not quite the right season. But the point that he wants to make is not that Jesus was being unfair, but rather the tree itself would have looked like it was the season for figs. Like on the outside, there would have been big, luscious leaves. And if you didn't know about the seasons, you'd look at it and go, oh, yeah, there are going to be figs there because it is purporting to be in full bloom. So there's something hypocritical about the tree, even though, of course, we understand that, you know, and I think Jesus understood as well that it wasn't time for figs. It gave the appearance of being full and fruitful. And yet when Jesus stuck his hand through the leaves, there was nothing there. And in a similar sort of way, he gets to this temple that is glorious. And, you know, we read about it last week and people saying, unless you've seen the temple, you've never seen a beautiful building. And Jesus goes, well, actually looks incredible on the outside. I get inside. And what do I see? Lack of fruitfulness. Like I say, we'll come back to that for a whole week. But I think, yeah, bang on. And very quickly, group four, what were your stories and, you know, what's the point? Anyone? Okay, so story one, parable about the Pharisee and the tax collector, and it's about who's humble. Story two, children come towards Jesus, and the disciples try and kick them out, and Jesus says, hey, no, the kingdom of heaven belongs to such as these. Third one, this guy comes to Jesus and says, what does the law require? He's the rich young ruler. How do I get into eternal life? And Jesus gives him an answer about that he doesn't really like, about selling all he has and distributing to the poor. Okay, common themes. We've got about 1 minute before the worship team rock up, so very quickly. Common themes, any particular points that come together? Yeah. Great. So it's a whole load of things about humility and status and Jesus turning on his head and some people getting it and other people not getting it. And yeah. I mean, so here's what I would say about it. First of all, you get this parable that is told to some who trusted in themselves. Okay, so look at verse 9. He told this parable to some who trusted in themselves that they were righteous and treated others with contempt. That's a clue from the author. So you know who is being addressed here. It's people who have an issue with hierarchy and humility and that sort of thing. Jesus tells the parable, and the disciples probably hear this and are like, ah, yeah, that really showed them. And then the kids flock to Jesus, and they're like, no, stay away. You can't come and bother the man. And Jesus is like, Don't you get the point? You're just making exactly the same mistake, having heard this stuff about humility and status. And so he tells the disciples off because they fail to apply it for themselves. And then thirdly, you get this guy who comes to Jesus illustrating a lack of humility. Similarly to the people in the first story, this guy seems to be trusting in his own works and ability to eternal life. And the humility that Jesus requires of him seems so radical and almost impossible that it's like, you know, this is, no one can do this. And yet the point is, what is impossible with man is truly possible only with God. So the theme for these three passages is humility and status. And it seems impossible for all people, poor and rich, disciple and newcomer, whoever you are, all of us struggle with this idea of hierarchy, of humility, of what is required by Jesus, and really it is impossible to earn salvation, but God gives it as a gift. And we've seen that illustrated in three particular ways. Yeah. Brilliant. Okay, I'm sure that was hugely rushed, and there's more we could say on all of that, but our time is up. I hope you found that helpful. Next week, we're going to look at Matthew and Mark and think about the particular things that each of those gospel writers draw out. And I hope that'll be helpful. If you do have time during this week, you might want to just glance over Matthew and Mark and give a little bit of thought to those. Otherwise, next week, we'll look at them in depth. Hope you enjoyed it. The recording will be up this week. If you do have any questions, do come and find me at the end. Happy to stay around and answer them. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. For more information or for further podcasts and downloads, please visit christchurchlondon.org.